Go ahead and jump in. We are through another week. Woohoo! So thanks for being here. And we had a couple questions because if you had clicked the little link when we first started the sprints to add it to your calendar, that actually ends on Monday. But we've decided to keep going. So we're extending it through at least the end of May. We don't have a definite time these are going through, but we're planning on continuing to do them until the quarantine's over and or nobody's showing up anymore. So, so we're planning on doing that. So I guess we'll just jump in on the Q&A. I don't think we had anything else. So if you have questions, go ahead and put them in the chat. And I'll get to those. And then we had a couple ahead of time. And Sean, do you have anything before we jump in?
No, I don't think so.
All right. So this one's from Anne. What genre would you call the work of Nick Hornby, such as High Fidelity or About a Boy? It doesn't seem to go all the way to literary fiction. Are you familiar with his work?
Yes. Well, I categorize literary fiction as a style more than a content genre. So the way I would categorize Hornby would be worldview education, worldview maturation, that sort of thing. Because essentially what he really locked into, in my opinion, was the phenomena of men not growing up and refusing to accept the responsibilities of, I don't want to get into gender politics, but the traditional male role model of behavior, which is, it's sort of like from, I'm sort of on the cusp of, I'm the last year of the baby boomer generation, which gives my children great pleasure because they can say, okay, boomer, all the time, and I can't correct them. So I was born in 1964, which was the last year of the baby boomer, and then Generation X is 65, and then we've got, I think, Generation Y, and then maybe the millennials and all kinds of sorts of stuff. But what I think Hornby is writing about and what he's really nailed is this phenomena of usually Generation X, the male character, just refusing to deal with reality in a way that our, you know, generation or the baby boom generation or the greatest generation did. So it's all about how these men come to the realization that they're not the center of the universe and that their immediate gratification and pleasures are not something to build a life on. So it's, I think these are really, really good books because they goose people into understanding that there's a greater, I was explaining this to my son earlier today. The way I equate it with sort of this opening up of the cognitive frame, and that's what I think Hornby is really all about. He's trying to write stories that encourage people to examine their lives in such a way that they can extend beyond their egocentric points of view. So a really good sort of metaphor about this is the Copernican revolution. So we used to look at the world as the Earth as the center of the universe. And so everything was Earth-centric. And then when we discovered that the Earth actually revolves around the sun, which is a far more powerful force that actually gives rise to living things on Earth, then we start to sort of move beyond our ego framing of earthbound desires and, you know, wants. And we get to see that there's something beyond our own individuation, our own individual lives. So this is part of the stuff that I've been exploring in terms of genre is, you know, what if the genres reflect Maslow's hierarchy of needs, then I see that the action genre is that egocentric movement forward to acquisition of a goal state, right? A want. I want an ice cream cone, therefore I go through some motor actions in order to get my ice cream cone. That is an action story. Because it, you know, it satisfies a primal need of sustenance, nourishment, etc. Okay, so that's the on-the-ground egocentric movement. Now, I believe that once the species discovered that we were no longer the center of the universe, a whole new level of cognition started to emerge. And that's what brought the Enlightenment. we literally enlightened to the fact that the sun is of a much higher order of meaning than we had ever equated it to be. So at the edges of our cognitive capability are this movement from what Jung called a movement from the ego to the self. And Jung kind of defined the self in the way that I define the noumenal, which is more Immanuel Kant kind of framing. The noumenal is that in which we cannot really fully ever understand. So when we start to expand our cognition beyond our egocentric points of view, we start to understand that in order to find some sort of meaning in our progression through the world, we need to transcend our own individual humanity. So that's what everybody here is trying to do. We're all trying to contribute to an expansion of the cognitive framing for the species. So let's get back to Nick Hornby and High Fidelity and About a Boy. Hornby was writing about this reluctance of a certain generation of men to assume their expansion of cognitive frame. And I think this is something that it's not male dominant. I think women and any gender anybody identifies with, all this is a human problem, is moving beyond our own egocentric worldview, action-oriented life, which I call the having mode. And the being mode is about becoming something of a higher nature, of expanding our minds and our framing of the world in such a way that we can start to take in the wonder of reality and contribute. So, you know, I mentioned on the call on Wednesday when we were talking about nonfiction, how it was probably, a lot of people were probably a little bit turned off when Tim sent the email saying, you know, we're gonna talk about how to write a work of nonfiction that will change the world. And that was a very deliberate decision, I think, on Tim's part, because what we believe at StoryGrid is that when the individual expands his or her own cognitive framing, they are really changing the world, because we are so embedded in reality and the world that when we change ourselves and we open up our framing, so does the world expand too. So when you endeavor to write something, that is the process by which you are doing it. It's almost alchemical. You're moving into a higher state of cognitive understanding and framing just by taking the steps of processing what it means and what it takes to create a scene, like these sprints. Everybody, I think, is anyone who's earnestly sort of going through this, it doesn't mean that they have a perfect scene at the end of the week, but anyone who's endeavoring a few hours a day, they're starting to kind of, things are starting to click, and they're opening up their framework, And so I would classify Hornby as essentially worldview maturation. And worldview maturation is, you know, opening up our cognitive framing. The worldview global genre itself is all about that. So I would not, I really kind of steer clear of calling something quote unquote literary, because I see it as a marketing ploy and sort of a gatekeeper means by which we can classify something as, if you read this, you're going to be part of this inside group that's really smart. I think it has an embedded bullshit factor to it. So it's not that literary is really a meaningless term in my, for me. And people kind of, they're like, oh, The New Yorker, that's literary. Well, yeah, but if there's no story there, like I looked at The New Yorker yesterday and I read maybe 1/10 of it. And it's not, you know, it's probably because I'm not smart enough to get the other 9/10 of it. But I love The New Yorker. I'm not putting it down, but there's this high level of literary sensibilities that I think push people away from writing that could be really good for them. So I'm not a big fan of saying, well, this is a literary masterpiece, because I think that's, the story is what matters to me.
All right, so this one's from Jewel. When using a masterwork for inspiration, how do you find the line between inspired versus ripping off?
Well, when you start using the exact same words, I would say that's ripping off. I would say that's plagiarism and wrong. Now, anything else, in my opinion, is fair game. So I don't think anyone who is writing seriously and has been at it for quite some time would ever find themselves put off by a fellow writer in the trenches being inspired by their construction of their story in such a way that they would say, oh, he ripped me off, or she ripped me off. I think every writer who's a professional understands just how hard this endeavor is. So, and whenever someone tells me, oh, that idea that you had, I totally ripped it off and it became kind of my shtick for my online sales course, I actually feel pretty good about that. It's not that I don't get offended. Sometimes I'm a little turned off, but not really. I kind of feel like, well, you know, it's nice that the message that I'm trying to get out there, somebody found it valuable and is sending it forward in a different frame. Now, if they actually use my literal words and don't say that, hey, I was inspired by X, then that's a little off-putting. But when it comes to masterworks, I don't believe anyone owns friends having dinner scene. I don't believe anybody owns Goliath approaches scene, right? So this is what we do at StoryGrid. We look at the masterworks and we abstract from the specificity of the scene or the writing in such a way that it can aid us as inspiration, as helping us connect to a specific time and place in our own experience. So all of the scenes that we worked on last summer for Ground Your Craft were all inspired by masterwork scenes. And that entire course is all about how you can use a masterwork to inspire you beat by beat in a scene progression. So Kim Kessler and Rebecca Monteruso, they were inspired by that idea, and they said, why don't we do an anthology of stories that can grow out of this Ground Your Craft course? And we're releasing that in a couple of weeks. It's called Four Core Fiction. And each of the stories in that anthology is inspired by a masterwork. So I think, I don't think anyone ripped off the masterworks when they wrote those stories. They were inspired by them, and they used the beat type in order to plumb the depths of their own mind. I can speak personally. I wrote a story in there about my masterwork scene was the revolution scene in Animal Farm. So I love George Orwell. I thought this would be a great thing to do. And I said to myself, the first question I had is, what do I know as well as George Orwell does about socialism? If George Orwell is to socialism, what is Sean Coyne to, right? And I'm like, oh, book publishing, right? I can do a story about book publishing. So, okay, great. So what stories do I have in my mind from my own experience that I know to be true? What can I rip off from my own experience and map it onto Orwell's framing of his beats? And that's what I did. And it, you know, it took a long time to do. It's probably okay. It's not the greatest thing I've ever written. It's not the worst. I'm proud of it. I gave it everything I had. But I think if Orwell came out of the grave and he read that story, you go, oh man, that's pretty cool. So you just took my thing and you twisted it a little bit and you did your take on it. Great. I'm glad I could help. That's, I think, the framing that he would. And Tilly Olson would say the same thing to Rochelle Ramirez and she, and et cetera, et cetera. So I think anything is fair game up until the point where you're ripping off literal language and turns of phrase and characterization. So the trick is, the question that you have to ask yourself is, are my scenes, which are inspired by the masterwork, grounded in the specificity of my own experience? If you pass that sniff test, go to town.
Okay. This one's from Megan. The last two assignments called for third-person omniscient narration. What are the hallmarks of third-person omniscient? I'm interested both in the technical side, word choice, sentence structure, etc., any dead giveaways that something is written in this style, and also in the emotional side. How are readers supposed to feel when they read it? What's the experiential goal of using it?
Well, third-person omniscient, you know, is the beginning of oral storytelling tradition. So, it goes back to Homer. It goes back to Gilgamesh. It goes back to the Bible. It goes back to the Quran. Third-person omniscient is the narration where the storyteller steps into the worldview of God. So it's a very, very serious business. When you're stepping into that role, you have to take it extraordinarily seriously. So the problem that people, I think, have with third-person omniscient is they don't quite know what they actually think or believe. And so they start to write it without really giving it much thought. And so I think this is a follow-up question from last week, which somebody asked about point of view and narrative device. And as artists and creators, we don't get to choose. We have to assume the role of gods, right? Because the way our evolution has progressed, we are gods. We have the ability as a species to wipe out everything. So all of those gods that we remember from mythology, from the Greek gods to the Roman gods, and we're all like, well, it's Ares is kind of, he's kind of a little bit crazy, and Venus, boy, she's kind of a backstabber, or whatever it is, right? All of those things we used to, our ancestors used to think as more powerful than human beings. And what's evolved over time is that we have assumed that sort of active power. So the creator, the writer, it's so important now that the creator and the writer assume that mantle of power, and they also need to understand what their state of the art of their wisdom framing is. So let me just start answering the other part of the question, and I'll kind of circle back to what I mean by the responsibility of the creator stepping into the shoes of the narrating God. The point is to give the listener deep truth, deep mythopoetic truth that will help them navigate their world. So when Homer wrote the Iliad and the Odyssey, he took that shit seriously. I mean, the first lines of the Odyssey or the Iliad or both of them are, he says a prayer to the gods and says, muse, he's invoking the muse because he understands that he doesn't want to mess this up. He wants to give it his all by using his wisdom framing to tell a story that will really help people navigate the world in a way that will provide meaning to them. So the Odyssey is if you want a hero's journey, the Odyssey is a pretty damn good one. Way before Jung, way before Campbell, right? So this stuff has been around a long, long time. And so the third person omniscient narration is it, what it conveys to the reader is, hey, come on over to the campfire. We're going to tell a story. And this is a story that I am going to try and tell in the best possible way that I can so that it will change you, the listener. So third person omniscient is really saying to the reader, I'm not going to waste your time. I have ascended into the sky, and I have come back with a story that will change your life for the better. You will change. This is another alchemical process that happens for the reader when they hear a great story or read a great story. It changes. We all know this. That's why we want to be writers, right? Everything, probably the top 10 things that have changed me have something someone has told me or I've read, or it's a story. So the third person omniscient is the most popular narrative device for a very good reason. Because what it's saying is, I'm going to have the courage, and when I'm speaking I'm talking about the creator, the writer, you, all of you, you're saying to the reader, I have the courage to put forward a story as if I am God. And I am going to tell you something that's extraordinarily important. So every story embeds a truth that the creator believes to themselves. So now this doesn't mean that you have to solve the riddles of the universe. It's simply what you're saying is, what's important is for you to expand your worldview. That's what I think all stories are about. It's exactly what I was talking about earlier. Get out of that egocentric, action-driven, want, have mode, You got to break that frame and look upward. You've got to think about, when I'm dead, what will people think of what I left behind? I'm gonna just take one tangential story, because I think this is a really good story about the necessity of understanding these two frameworks, the having mode and the being mode. So I was listening to a podcast by a guy named Eric Weinstein, and he's a really smart guy, and I really enjoy his stuff. And what was wonderful is a few months ago, he had his brother, Brett Weinstein, on. So we have this really great framing of a podcast where two brothers are talking. And Eric Weinstein is not afraid of speaking his mind any longer. He's about my age, and he sort of just says whatever the hell he thinks at this point. So he's kind of like dressing down his brother, Brett, and he's trying to get his brother, Brett, to be really indignant about something that happened to Brett. So just to make a long story short, Brett, when he was in his PhD, he was doing some biology work. He is an evolutionary biologist, very bright guy. He came up with a really amazing theory about some really strange things that were happening with laboratory mice. So because he was just a PhD student and he was not a molecular biologist, he needed to consult with somebody who was an expert molecular biologist. So he called one of the premier molecular biologists, and he had a conversation with her for several weeks, going over his theory. And she's like, this is really interesting. And flash forward, years later, she won the Nobel Prize. And she published a bunch of papers that were about what Brett Weinstein had proposed to her, but she didn't give him any credit. So she's giving her speech at the Nobel lecture, and Brett Weinstein was explaining to his brother, Eric, he had tuned in, he went out in the yard with a radio, and he was listening to her lecture, and he discovered that she was presenting all of the things that he had talked to her about as if it was her own work. And he said it was the greatest moment of his life and the worst moment of his life. And I was struck by that. I said, how could that be the greatest moment of your life? And the way he explained it was, hey, I had an idea that I thought was really super important, and I think it needed to get out into the world. I needed it to move out of my brain into the collective unconscious. So, hey, guess what? I got what I needed. That's really what we all need, isn't it? We all need to take what's inside our minds that we think is really important and get it out into the world. So he said, I was elated that my work had been shared at the Nobel Prize lecture. Now, the difficult part was that he didn't get any credit for it. So he didn't get what he wanted, but he got what he needed. And Eric didn't like this, because Eric wants justice, and rightfully so. But Brett, you could just look at the two figures and listen to them, and you kind of say, you know, Brett seems like he's okay with it, you know? Like, and I was really moved by that, because he took on the godlike third person omniscient point of view. And he said, I'm going to pretend as if my idea is really important. In fact, that maybe it could change the world. And I'm going to go to the nth degree to make sure that at least my idea is out in the world. And if I can get my idea out in the world, whether or not I get credit for it isn't going to destroy me. You know, he probably has more than one idea. I suspect he does. So I think this is the real requirement that we have to take on when we create something. You know, don't let it destroy you and make you, oh my God, this is so important. But you have to say to yourself, I really need to figure out what I think. And once I figure out what I think, I need to embed what I think in a story. And what I think is kind of what everybody thinks. It's important. It's meaningful to take what's inside of us and to craft a story that will change people. So the third person omniscient narrative is the most popular narrative because it allows us to step back from our own egocentric bullshit and say, well, what's the point of me doing all these sprints anyway? Oh, I get it. Because if I can keep doing these sprints, I can move the pebble a little bit. I'll get closer to the understanding of what exactly it is I want to convey in my story. And then I'll be okay, right? So, you know, I'm also rereading Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. And that's another story that I just lose it, right? I think to myself, how did this woman have the courage to write this book, right? I mean, she wrote this book 50 years ago in the worst race, you know, it's horrifying. Imagine all of the things that were telling her to stop it. What are you doing? Nobody cares about your crap. But she kept on, and she kept on, and she kept on. And she wrote an amazing story that was all true, and it was all grounded in the specificity of her experience. And then she found an editor, a guy who recently died. Robert Loomis, fantastic editor, worked at Random House for 55 years. And what I live in the same town where Robert Loomis did, and they had a really nice obituary. And I noticed every obituary photo of Loomis has a photo of him sitting with Maya Angelou, and he's holding on to her hand for dear life. And here you got this white guy who went to Duke, who had all the advantages, and he's holding on to Maya Angelou for dear life because he found his meaning by helping her release her story. And those two people were so interconnected for so long. He edited everything she wrote. So anyway, the third person omniscient narrative, it's a responsibility we all have to take seriously. And the reason why it's so popular is because we are assuming that we have godlike capabilities as creators. And the truth is, every single one of us does. Every single one of us has that capability. And when you say, I'm throwing caution to the wind, I'm going to assume that role as a godlike narrator, and the hell with it, I'm doing it. Then you start to connect with the real specificity of your own life experience in a way that's more genuine and loving and real, because you're saying to yourself, oh, that thing that happened to me when I was 7 that I can't really deal with, you know what? That's good shit. I'm going to put that in my book. And that's what Maya Angelou did. She didn't back away from anything. Because I think she's like, you know, this really isn't about me, Maya Angelou. It's about telling a story that can change people. You read that book, you're changed. It's over for you, right? It's forget it. And that's what we all want to do. So if you can be comfortable, and not only just be comfortable, but to say, I'm going to take that 30,000 foot view. I'm going to look at all of my intricate, ego-driven life experience, and I'm going to go, great, it's content. How am I going to use this? Instead of going, oh, I don't want to say that secret thing that happened to me because that's really scary. And no, you're God. God doesn't care about your fear, and neither should you. Just mine it. That stuff, share it. And share it by using Masterworks to help you frame it. All right, so enough of that sermon.
All right, this one's from Alyssa. Any tips for making a scene with two characters talking at dinner more interesting without blowing something up? Do you think these scenes tend to work better later in a book when the reader is already invested in the characters?
Well, you know, I'm not going to insult everyone by starting to list possible unexpected events that you can drop into a dining scene. The waiter could throw up on them. Ping pong balls could fall from the roof. Somebody could say, I actually hate you, and it's time that you know it, right? So you got to think of dialogue is verbal action. So you don't necessarily have to have massive external action to create an unexpected event. Harold Pinter was classic at this. He did a series, he did a play called Betrayal, which goes back in time. And there's a great dinner with friends scene where the one friend is trying to suss out whether or not the other guy slept with his wife. And it's a very intricate scene. And all they talk about is Torcello and the wine and this and that. And as a viewer in the audience, you know what's going on, and it's excruciating because you're just say it already. Did you slip, you know? So, when you put in these scenes, again, there's no algorithm to it. I suggest that if your inclination, your first inclination is, oh, this is a great place to do a dinner with friends scene, don't do it, right? If your first inclination, however, is to do, oh, this is the scene where I'll have somebody beat somebody up, then do a dinner with friends scene and don't have anybody beat anybody up. So when the thing I always remember is like that first instinct that you have is probably not the best choice. Because guess what happens when the first thing that comes to our mind is usually a cliche from another form of story that we've seen 36 times before, and we kind of think it's original to us, but it's not. It's sort of like a mimetic regurgitation of other people's work. So that doesn't mean that you can't, knowing that is great. Because when you know that, this is why one of the things I love to do with writers I'm working with is to spitball ideas. Because when you spitball, you go out, well, what if we do dinner with friends? And the other person goes, no, that's stupid. And then you move on, and it doesn't become precious, and you don't end up spending 4 hours doing a scene. Instead, they would say, well, what about this? Well, if we do that, we've got to do it in a different way. How are we going to make it different? So dinner with friends is a super duper skill to have. When you know and you can bang these things out and you know, it's like knowing how to jump rope. Once you know how to jump rope and you need to get some exercise and there's a jump rope there, you can just do it, right? So if you can master sort of playing with the dinner with friends scenes in different unexpected events that turn the value, it doesn't have to turn the value from seduction to life death. It could turn it from confrontation to confession, something like that. Just think about what's the most inappropriate thing or weird thing somebody could do in this scene and lead up to it, and then you have the fallout. I think I talked earlier about there's a Invisible Man, that recent movie. It does dinner with friends and it uses from the playbook from Zero Dark Thirty. So, there's an example of someone using a masterwork and innovating it, but it's the same effect.
This one's from Anne. The book I chose as a masterwork to base my structure on has third-person limited point of view for every character. So there are 9 different point of view characters, and the author uses them to transition and to show characters from each other's perspective. The protagonist is kind of like the lead of an ensemble and has about twice as many point of view scenes as every other character. What are some pitfalls I might encounter if I choose to follow this point of view device? Should I consider following the beats but not the point of view device? It seems kind of central to the charm of the book, so many perspectives. This makes me think of when I was looking at Agatha Christie's, one of her books, and it was the one where they're all on the island and somebody dies and you're kind of jumping around. And I remember, and then I was reading about it and she said it was the hardest book she ever wrote. I was like, maybe I shouldn't start with that one.
Yeah, that's kind of my answer. It's sort of like using Game of Thrones as your masterwork. You got to remember, Martin had been writing for 30 years, 25 years before he did that. And it works. It's almost impossible that it works in the way that it does. The guy's just operating at a level that took him quite a long time to reach. So, you know, I think probably... you know, there's the famous story about To Kill a Mockingbird when she, Harper Lee, you know, she first started with third person omniscient and was doing a lot of point of view from Atticus's point of view. And her editor finally said, you know, just hone in on that one central thing. And I think when we're writing our first novels, when we're starting, like when you apprentice with a carpenter, they don't have you do an intricate, you know, Rococo chair when you start. They're like, okay, I'm going to teach you how to pick up a hammer, right? It's the first, or John Wooden, the famous UCLA basketball coach, the first thing he did at practice on the first day of every year, no matter what player came to him, is he said, the first thing I'm going to teach you is how to put on your socks. And then I'm going to teach you how to properly lace your shoes. And he would do that. And they would say, why do you do that? And he'd go, what's the one thing that can destroy a season is when somebody gets injured. What's the easiest injury to prevent? Blisters. Nobody on my team is going to be out with a blister. So the first thing I do is to teach everyone how to put on their socks and how to lace up their shoes so that they don't get knocked out of the game. He doesn't teach them super high level alley-oop passing on the first day of practice. So if you're trying to learn how to play basketball, you might want to learn how to put on your socks first. So doing 9 different levels of point of view, that's, you know, I just edited, we're about to publish an epic novel that took me 3.5 years to edit. And one of the major problems is that there are at least 8, there's probably 14 to 15 plot lines and 8 major characters. Now, it's not written in, it's not written from the point of view of each of those characters, but just that was plenty to keep me busy. And the writer, and he did 3 page 1 rewrites based upon the work that we worked together over time. And it took him 12 years to get the draft to me. So 12 years to write a draft, and then 3.5 years of 3 page 1 rewrites, meaning rethinking scenes, rewriting scenes, changing characterization, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm sure once he thought he delivered that 12 years of work to me, that he would do we'll do a polish, right? And then it'll be ready. And to his credit, each time I said, you know what, we got to go back to the beginning, we got to go through this again, he was like, okay, all right, let's do it. And I think that's the attitude you have to have. So whether or not he, if I asked him now, would you have rather have started with one character, a 60,000 word crime story featuring a single protagonist to get your feet wet? He probably would have been, yeah, I probably should have done that. But he was compelled. He was just compelled to do this thing. And I'm convinced that if I didn't come along, he would still be writing the next novel. And, you know, this is the kind of thing he would dump on his daughters after, you know, at his death, you know, like, you must make sure you read that my novel that I write, right? So I suggest that you pull back and maybe find something that this writer had written earlier in their career and take a look at that as a masterwork. If you insist on doing it, though, then the way I would structure it is to think of each character as a separate novel. Think of each plot line as 10 to 15,000 words and work on them one at a time. Break down your problem. Don't look at it as like 12 problems all swimming together at once. No, what I did with Mike is I literally went and I got 15 different colors of index cards. And each color represented one of the characters. And then I went through my 15 scenes of story spine for each one of those characters. And I answered all those questions. And all those questions I could not answer, I confronted Mike with them and said, why don't we have an answer to this question? Oh yeah, I didn't even really think about that. Well, then you can do that with each of your 9 characters. And then if you look at them as individual 10,000 word, 10 to 15,000 word plot lines, and it doesn't mean you have to do, you can basically then start, figure out what the story is, your spinal thread for each of those characters, do these index cards, and then one at a time, write the narrative and think about the world from that character's point of view. Okay, then you pile them up. And then you've got 9 different things, and then you look at them and you sort them based upon the timeline of the story. Oh, this character and this character did the same thing the same day, right? So then you track out and then you start making cuts and you start thinking of the story in terms of a movie editor. How can I cut this thing into a coherent narrative? And what's fun about that is that if each of your storylines, like maybe one's super status oriented, maybe one's a love story, then what you do is you drop the love story into a critical moment of the character's status story, and then you have an unexpected change that will compel the reader to keep going. You know, it's not easy for me to speak in total abstractions about how to work a 9 character thing in a 2-minute call, but generally I always approach problems like that. I go, oh shit, I can't handle that. What can I handle? I can handle one character and maybe one scene. All right, so who's my favorite character? What's my favorite scene idea? Let me do that. I'm gonna do that one today. All right, I'm gonna put that aside. What's gonna happen to this character next, right? So it's these very simple first principle ideas that can keep you from the, oh my God, I'm never gonna do this. This is, I'm a mad person for ever considering this quest. Sean warned me about this, I shouldn't do it. I'm not saying that. Just take it easy, think one character at a time, and guess what? You can always change your mind. You can always fix it later. So that's, analyzing a 9 point of view story masterwork is a great thing to do, because it will really open up your framing about how to tell a story well, but it can also drive you to despair. So I would also ask myself this question. Why am I so fascinated by this story? Am I setting myself up to fail for some reason? Or is this really, I really need to devote 10 years of my life to this? Maybe I could devote a year and a half to a 20,000 word novella like, I don't know, The Old Man and the Sea. That's a tiny little book. And you could write that in a year and a half. So that's a good starting point. Okay, that's it for that.
All right, this one's for Mike. It's a pretty heady one, so bear with me here. Okay, I'm interested in how our experience of the material world, noumenal, and our perceptions or reactions to it, phenomenal, intersect with our brushes with the liminal world, the feeling that we are on the verge of something much larger than we encounter on the material plane. Can you respond to how that might play into the story grid paradigm?
Yeah, first, I think you have it mixed up. The phenomenal is the material, and the noumenal is the metaphysical. So phenomenal is physical, noumenal is the metaphysical. Where does the phenomenal and the noumenal fit in? That fits in the phenomenal progression, how we deal with material unexpected events, external unexpected events, verbal unexpected events. That's what happens in the action story, right? So the action story has those components of dealing with literal things that happen to us on Earth. Okay? Somebody says something to us. The environment does something to us. We have to adapt to that change, that coincidental or causal change in our experience, through motor action, right? Either we verbally spit something out or we do something. Okay, so that's everything that's going on in the egocentric world space. So above the clouds, however, that's all of the things that are funneling through our minds, our code of behavior. I must do this because of that. If I want to become a big shot in book publishing, I have to go through the process by which you become a big shot in New York book publishing, right? So that's a framing that drove the first 8 to 9 years of my career. I couldn't even imagine not being part of that gated institutional network. But I had to break that framing, right? So that's opening up your mind and breaking frame so that you can engage with the noumenal. The noumenal are all those things that we sort of, it's like when people have kind of out of body experiences or LSD trips, or this is all well documented. I'm not talking about being freaky or weird here, but it's been proven, magic mushroom, psilocybin trips. What people experience when they do that is they have some kind of ineffable experience that they can't really literally communicate. They can just say like, well, it's just really cool. That's all, you know, or they'll say it's love, or it's I saw God, or it's not very easy to communicate because I think it's in an experiential realm that is not language derived. Okay, so that experience of having something that we can't quite understand, but knowing that it's real, right? Like we all might be like, well, I'm not really sure if that's real or not. And when you reach a level of sort of cognitive openness, and this is what the Buddha taught, you know, it's transcendental meditation. You go inward and then you meditate outward. So it's a micro examination and then an expansion macro. So this is across cultures. That is the way. That is the way to find meaning. That is the heroic journey. That is the story grid definition of the cognitive science of the heroic journey. The heroic journey seems to be like, well, I have to go get this gift and this treasure and I have to go on a trip. And it's not that. It's literally breaking the frame of your mind so that you have new insights that allow you to attune yourself to the natural world at the highest possible level. So when we're talking about leveling up in StoryGrid, it's not only leveling up your active motor craft of writing scenes, it's also about leveling up your cognitive capability to open up the framing and to be able to answer these questions all by yourselves. Like, come on, you really need me to give you an unexpected event other than a bomb happening at dinner with friends? I know that wasn't really a literal question, but seriously? Oh, gee, you all know how to answer that question. This is what I meant about assuming the role of God. Like, don't look toward some oracle to tell you how to relate your own personal experiences. It's like that Bruce Springsteen song, Darkness on the Edge of Town, right? Everyone has a secret. We all have these secrets. Being a writer and a creator is about confronting those secrets and releasing them. Maya Angelou had a secret. She released her secret. Did she survive? Did she die because it destroyed her? No. In fact, it didn't. It emboldened her. It made her even more of a luminary agent, right? So she shined light on a darkness that people don't want to confront. So that's what I talk about. That's what I mean when I say getting into the noumenal is to just for a moment think, you know, there's some shit I'm just never going to know. And that's okay. But what I want to do is get closer to whatever that thing is by opening up my cognitive framing and encouraging other people to do it too. Because when we do that and when we set on the act of creating, we do level up psychically. Everyone a little bit, every time you write something, you're just opening up a little bit. You're like, geez, shit, I never really thought of it that way. But there it is on the page. Wow, that's something. It's like Steve Pressfield talks about the muse. I don't really believe in a literal muse. But I do believe in the idea of the noumenal. And I think Steve does, and that's cool, and I love it. But it doesn't mean that I can't relate to what Steve's saying because I don't believe in a literal muse. I believe in some sort of scientific dimensionality that has more information than we can process, that is true, that's real. That we need to consider. And that's sort of what I think when we're in that process of creation. It's like we get into this flow state. The time passes so quickly, we don't even realize it. That is an open-ended cognitive framing that is exploring the noumenal space that changes us. So every story that we tell has this embedded thing inside of it. And those are the things that work because people know this inside their cells. This is the same story as Homer is telling. This is all about expanding our cognitive framing, breaking frame, to live in the being mode instead of so much on the having mode, to look at the sun and to explore, holy crap, there's so much stuff there's no way I will know. That is what I mean about, and the liminal space, just to answer that part of it, the liminal space are all those needs. So we liminally sort of try and get these needs met so that we can break open. But what's ironic or paradoxical The only way to get these liminal needs like love and self-respect and all that stuff, that Maslow stuff that make up our genre content, the only way to do that is to break open that frame, and then we get what we need. If we're confining our framework, that's my story and I'm sticking to it, we're never going to get what we need. Because what we need is to attune to truth. And I believe the noumenal space is true. And I think everybody deep down would say, yeah, I think there's some shit that we just don't know. And that's okay. But why don't we attune and maybe something can open up and come down and help? That's what Jung talks about synchronicity. That's what he's talking about. It's like when we open up our framing, external things can happen that open up our internal framing. It's a good place to end.
Yeah. All right. Well, in there. All right. Thanks, Sean. We will see you on Monday.
Okay. Great.
All right.